Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center. We love to talk politics and current affairs, and I have on the political right, Senator Dan McKay.
Hello, Natalie. Hello, Shireen, Anthony, everybody. Good to see you.
Shireen, we have you on the political left. Great to have you on the program again.
Hello, and hey to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
Dan and Shireen, I have a leadership team retreat with my team at the Gardner Institute, and I was writing down a list of things for context. Pandemic, Fed deliberations, SCOTUS vacancy, populism, China, Russia. I mean, it was quite the list to just kind of think about what's happening in our world. And let's just start out the program by just for a minute talking about what's going on in the Ukraine, where the Pentagon has put 8,500 troops, U.S. troops, on high alert. I've been watching the Secretary of State, you know, with his really everyday comments about what's going on, where diplomacy, NATO, all the ingredients to a very serious situation. Shireen, you've spent time in this part of the world. Give us a little bit of color commentary.
Sure. So this is a situation that is certainly escalating pretty quickly, though it's been going on for quite a while. Troops have been on the border of Ukraine for quite a bit of time. I spent 2 years in the Republic of Moldova, which not a lot of people know this area of the world very well, but is the next door neighbor to Ukraine. It's the last kind of satellite country down in that corner, just north of Turkey and sandwiched in between Romania and Ukraine. This is a place where, you know, we're starting to hear stories and concerns about gas, natural gas moving into Europe, that there could be, you know, cut off of supplies of some critically important pieces of infrastructure. That's something that I experienced in Moldova. Moldova had made some move that made Russia very angry, and the gas lines come in from Ukraine into Moldova, and they would close them off. So this is a really serious concern. Of course, we've got the concern of, you know, invading a country and what that might mean. But there have been some really interesting reports from coming out of Russia are coming out of Ukraine as well. So individuals saying, people who'd worked in the military saying they feel like maybe it's happening, but not just now. There haven't been medics or you know, camps set up to respond to medical needs. And so they think that it's possible that Russia's waiting until after the Olympics, which is wild when you think about the context that's happening in kind of this bigger picture. But this is a tense situation, and it is a really troubling move on Russia's part in terms of violating their statehood.
Yeah. Dan, I don't know if you've been following the news, but Utah County Attorney David Levitt, you know, he taught for, I think it was the American Bar Association in Kiev in Ukraine. But he's over there now. It turns out he ended up getting COVID and is stuck in Amsterdam. But in the reporting I saw, he talked about the tension the people were feeling, the sad feelings and a feeling of foreboding. And I just kind of think, I'm sure you think about it, Shireen, knowing these people, but I just think of sitting there in that country, knowing that you're, you know, in the middle of a world crisis.
Well, and let's think about this. This is not a people that is alien to war, right? They're used to it. And in some ways, you know, people talk about, you know, war or that kind of things. And I you know, it's interesting in the United States, we've not fought a war on our ground in, you know, decades. And in, you know, you get to the 1940s, really, when we saw, you know, even the remotest threat in, you know, in Hawaii. You look at where we are now today, it's been a long time, but that area of the world, they're like, they know what it's like. That feeling, I am confident, that's a feeling none of us want to feel. I pray that we never have to feel it. But at the same time, my heart goes out to anybody stuck in the middle of that situation, because it is not going to be positive.
Yeah.
And I'm worried about the U.S. response to it. Honestly, I don't know. Like, what? How are we going to balance all of the domestic issues that we have going on here and then stack on top of the domestic issues the issues that we have with a potential war or a war front in Ukraine? This is like advanced living. I don't know that anybody's ready for that.
Make no mistake about it. I think that Mr. Putin senses our vulnerabilities, and it empowers him. So that from the political middle, what I would hope for is that there's a unified U.S. response and that it's not politicized. But back in politics, we got to talk about the Supreme Court. But just quickly before we do that, I saw that the Arizona Democratic Party censured Senator Kyrsten Sinema. Dan, no surprise there, was it?
No. And, you know, the funny thing is, okay, I will just highlight this about the media just a little bit because this will make Shireen happy. But if you read about it, in some ways, the read about the press's response to Sinema being like censured by her own Democratic Party. And in the press, they seem to be okay with it. Like, it's okay. Like, it was a good idea. But when you had Senator Romney be censured by his party or people in his party, you had people writing about it as though the party was crazy. And it's super interesting when you see that kind of, I think they're both bad. Like, neither one of their parties should really be censuring their U.S. senator. But you can tell the press was kind of cheering for some of the policies that they wanted to see get passed. It was really weird to see that.
Yeah. Shireen, your reaction?
Yeah, I would just say I don't think this is, you know, particularly good politics for anybody. But I would also say it's deeply disappointing, and her approval rating is not good in Arizona. And when we look at, you know, the issues that are on the table, whether it's voting rights or thinking about, you know, really the big problems that we're having getting a functional Congress, it would be nice to have a senator who is on the team. But it feels like we don't have that.
Mm-hmm. You know, they call it the People's House because of the 2-year term. And it is really close to the people. Like, if you don't perform, if the public doesn't like what you're doing, you're out. Very interesting.
You know, I did hear one thing that was interesting about it, though. So, you know, you hear the names Sinema and you hear Manchin, you hear those names because
over and over
those
again.
These are freshmen, you know, or no, not Manchin's not, but Sinema is a freshman. But these are really, you know, moderate lawmakers, kind of in the middle, represent Republican states that Trump actually won out in West Virginia. And then, you know, Arizona, Biden won. But it was a close victory, right? But these two senators were in the White House negotiating bills, negotiating issues. And all of those that are on the far left or even on the far right, they're not involved in these. Right?
Yeah.
Senator Romney, Senator Sinema, Senator Manchin, they're right in the middle of it. And I will say, that's got to be a good place for their states to be in.
Yeah, they're influencing. Yeah. Hey, so Justice Breyer, if I remember this right, he was a Clinton appointee. Am I getting that right? And 83, something like that. But this is has been characterized as a seismic moment, historic moment. In part because President Biden has made a campaign commitment that he says he will keep to appoint a black woman to the court. One of the things I loved is that there's so many choices. Immediately I see all the biographies of all these incredible women, black women throughout our country that have risen to be, you know, to have a judicial temperament and to have the experience. Shireen, when you saw the news, I mean, what did you think?
Well, I was interested to see, you know, how quickly we would start to see Republicans calling to wait, right? And those messages, those tweets, those statements did start coming out. But I do think that we are served well by a diverse court. And I think that it would be nice to have some change in that respect. And I hope that we see people who are really bringing, as you're suggesting, the demeanor, I would just love for us to be able to rebuild trust in this institution. Mm-hmm. I don't think one appointment is going to do that. But I think it's a moment where we could start to maybe shift back the narrative about what is happening on our Supreme Court. But I know that we're also talking about some news in the court system a little closer to home. Do we want to talk about that too?
Yeah, we should. Just before we jump there, Dan, what are you predicting? Do you predict that this SCOTUS nomination will be as crazy as the last few, or do you think that we can get this done and move forward?
I would like to hope that, you know, well, I campaign promise and everything else aside, I think it's great. Black female lawyer, fantastic, right? Replace Justice Breyer, that's great. I'm not of the wait Republicans. I say, hey, now's as good a time as any, and let's get it done. But I'll say this. It's a real bummer. I feel bad for Merrick Garland, like a little bit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because now he's got his president. He's the attorney general. And, you know, the campaign promise was made and now he's going to be overlooked. And bless his heart, like it's tough to time all of those things and want to be on the Supreme Court and then not to be there. So it's okay. I don't hear a lot of my Democratic friends calling for Merrick Garland, which is really kind of a bummer for him.
Yeah. From the political middle, I'll just say I hope the Biden team does a very careful review so that once we have that candidate, that it's foolproof and that it doesn't deteriorate into some of the things that we've seen with the most recent candidates that I think did have some problems in their background. If I remember, Justice Sotomayor had bipartisan support, and that's what I'm hoping we'll see. Shereen, let's go to Dan first because he's the attorney mm-hmm. and follows this. But you mentioned that the Utah Supreme Court has some vacancies. So, Dan, tell our listeners what's up there.
Yeah, so we're losing two judges. We have Justice Simonis from the Supreme Court. He announced his resignation earlier. He's going back into private practice. And then you have Justice Tom Lee, who is also leaving the Utah Supreme Court. Justice Simonis, I was looking it up. He was appointed in 2015 by Gary Herbert. Tom Lee was appointed in 2010 by Gary Herbert. And so, you know, we're losing actually one of the more recent judges for private practice, and they're going to go out and do their own thing. And I'm personally, you know, we talked about this off the air. I'm going to miss Justice Simonis. Like, I'm going to miss him because I really like his well-reasoned opinions, and so it's going to be a bummer. And Tom Lee was always a consistent, principled Constitution guy, and so he's been fantastic. Anyways, two good justices. Now Governor Cox has an opportunity to really put his first fingerprints on the Utah Supreme Court.
Yeah. Shereen, we're running out of time in the segment, but what do you hope to see from Governor Cox?
Well, again, I think that, you know, it's important when we have people from different life backgrounds. And so I hope that we get to see a little bit of that. I think that it makes it just changes the way our justice system works and in a way that I think is good.
Yeah. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Natalie Gochner with Dan McKay and Shereen Gourbani. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we have the Utah legislature in session. It was quite a colorful start. But Dan, it's really good to just get someone from the inside who's, you know, been in the House, now in the Senate, has an important committee assignment. Let's talk about what's going on in Capitol Hill and start with tax cuts. Our state's prospering. We're sitting on a lot of money. And so we're going to give some back. Yeah.
Yeah. We're looking at education, you know, the education fund, and I call it that just because income tax is a sole source of revenue for education, and it is growing the fastest. We've incentivized job growth. We've incentivized a lot of things, and what you incentivize, you get a lot of, right? And we're getting a lot of income tax revenue come in. You've seen almost a 10% new additional investment in education this last year. So over $350 million off the top of my head that we've already set aside to cover both growth and salary and increased wages and everything else. And so I think you're going to see a little bit more commitment made that direction. Maybe, you know, bonuses or some other, you know, one-time ways of looking at revenue. But you know, we're doing a lot really with the income tax that we have, and we're getting to the end of it. They're getting to kind of the end of it and saying, well, we can either make some investments in decisions that might not be sustainable long term, or, you know, we can make some minor tax cuts. We can, you know, some other things. So basically, we've decided that we're going to do some minor tax cuts. And, you know, everybody's like, well, you know, $160 million, that's not minor. Well, when you're, you know, when you're looking at $1 billion+ in surplus revenue, and by the way, the new numbers that come out in February are going to show that we have even more surplus in our income tax fund. And so we're going to be making, you know, some other tough decisions. I don't know what it was like for you, Natalie, but I was once told that the hardest years of being up at the state level is when you have a lot of money left over.
Yeah, sure. Shireen, so he's Dan's, you know, he's a leader here. I mean, in the paper, it'll be his picture as the person carrying the bill and announcing this income tax cut, taking it from a 4.95% rate to 4.85%. Yeah. Am I getting that right?
It's 10 basis points. Yep.
Yeah. Shireen, it's about $98 for the typical Utah family that makes $72,000
a year. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I continue to think about the places where we fall behind as a state. The fact that we, you know, have kind of a stunningly high rate of uninsured children. When we think about things like the fact that we're still very low in per student spending in our school system. When we think about the fact that we're incredibly low, I've been doing some work on cancer screening. We're incredibly low when it comes to breast cancer screening, kind of the basics. It seems to me that a smart government, an agile government, could do a balance of, you know, finding ways to improve people's lives, that amount of money coming back into the pockets of Utahns. In some regards, I think I understand. It makes sense to me. I know that that's a good talking point on the right. But I look around and I think that there are so many ways that we could improve the lives for those who have the least in this state. And I know that there's some actually really good legislation around that this year. But I hope that that continues to be a priority going forward.
Mm-hmm. Dan, I love that there's been some talk of an earned income tax credit. So this is the idea that it's very targeted to people who work, who aren't making a lot of money. They get a tax credit. It's a big incentive to work, and it actually helps bring people back into the labor force, which is something we really need. There's a lot of empirical evidence that it helps with labor force participation. What's the latest on that, Dan? I don't know this. I just know that it's being proposed, and I can you tell our listeners how many states have a state level EITC?
I think there's a little over 23 or 24 states that have an EITC. I'll have to look that up to be 100%, but you've got Google, use it, listeners. What I'd say is it's not a majority of states yet. And if you look at what the EITC does, is it does have a work component related to it. And people that qualify or are under a certain income level, they get a direct rebate on their taxes. And that, I think, is a very targeted and specific way to get right to specifically those who need it the most, right on the EITC side. The other part of this that's long been called for by advocates, AARP and others, where you're looking at Social Security income and saying, should we be taxing Social Security income? And I've said, well, we probably shouldn't be taxing Social Security income if it's the only source of revenue. But when people have, when they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars and Social Security's there, I'm not really probably going to give them another cut as a percentage of their revenue. So that's really, I think, when you look at what the tax policy is going to finally evolve. We're trying to get this done by week three, which on a tax cut side has actually never been done. And so the idea of having a tax cut that includes Social Security and potential for an earned income tax credit is a massive change and honestly can be a benefit for the state of Utah. I think Shireen's right, though, and there are always competing priorities as we're doing so many things for so many of these other programs. It's important to not forget those who are making sure that money shows up at the state level every year. That's all I say.
Sure. And one of the things that I think I'd be interested in is, when we're talking about things like the earned income tax credit or even the child tax credit, there was a push to get people to get that who maybe don't file taxes. So I would love if we could get more sophisticated around that. What are we doing to ensure that people are filing their taxes, even if they are below that poverty line, even if it doesn't necessarily make sense for them, because there are so many other opportunities to bring people support if they are in that system. It's, not my favorite way that we're necessarily catching people, but I think it's an important piece that I don't feel like there's as much of an emphasis on.
Hmm. Well, that's why we love Shireen, so she can bring everybody's attention to it.
Shireen, I wonder what you're thinking when you see all these bills that are, a new one that has a pretty sophisticated plan to save the Great Salt Lake from drought. It has all these unprecedented guidelines that are based on lake levels. And if you break it all down, they're basically using the power of markets and water prices to keep more water in the lake. Or get more water to the lake.
To the lake. This is something we've discussed before. I do think that, you know, when we talk about free market capitalism or really talk about the way that it should function or markets should function, that we are not anywhere close to paying what water is worth. And if we can move in that direction and that can help our lake, that is going to be critically important. But again, that's a burden that comes back onto people who you know, may be surprised by that. But it's an investment that we must make. It's important for our economy. It's important for our ecology here.
User fees have what we call the benefits principle. The people that benefit from the service pay for it. Dan, Burgess Owens goes up to Capitol Hill, snubs the Democrats. Why do that? I mean, it's a given that you're going to get bad press for it, and it just doesn't. I mean, he's supposed to represent everyone in his district, not just the Republicans.
Yeah. So it depends on who you talk to. Burgess says he wasn't invited. Congressman Owens says he wasn't invited to the Democratic caucus. They said he was on their agenda, but, you know, he wasn't invited. I don't know how all that works. What I can tell you is I don't mind going and visiting the Democrats, even though I know that I'm a stake in the middle of a room of pit bulls. I'm okay with that. I have been there on numerous occasions, and I look forward to the next time I get to go get chewed up. It's fantastic. And I would argue Congressman Owens is probably better off for letting Brian King take a small piece of him.
Shireen, your commentary on that. I mean, when you saw it, were you surprised? How should the average Utahn react to a congressman that won't meet with one, you know, chooses not to meet with the other party when he's up visiting Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I don't think it's good. My understanding is that Chris Stewart had done this a couple of years, but has now been visiting the Democrats, which is nice. It's a small body, and I think it's a bunch of people who are, interested in trying to solve problems for the state. Supposedly, that's what our congressmen are also interested in. So I would hope that there could be a healthy dialogue, but perhaps we're beyond that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Congressman Owens' senator, and, you know, I frequently have to introduce myself, so I hope the Democrats don't feel too bad.
Representative Burgess Owens, I am one of your constituents. I'm a political moderate. I've been a lifelong Republican. Please go visit the Democrats when you're on Capitol Hill. Okay. Shireen, point in time count. Tell our listeners what that is and why you and Dan are volunteering some time this week.
Yeah, so this week, and this is happening actually across the nation, there is an effort called the Point in Time Count. People call it the PIT. This is an effort that's often run out of county governments. Cities run it, as I mentioned, all across the country in January, typically for 3 nights. And the idea is to get out and really count and have conversation with our unhoused Utahns. The purpose of this is it's actually tied back to reporting that determines HUD funding. So it's tied to federal reporting. But it's also an opportunity to really connect with people and to try to, you know, offer services and really get a sense of the scope of homelessness in our state. So this is going to happen all across our entire state. So we have people that are going out in St. George. We have people in downtown Salt Lake City. I'll be one of those people. We have people out in our rural communities as well. And the idea here is, again, to just provide good information so that decisions can be made. I think one of the things that's so difficult about this is we interact with and think about kind of the complexities around homelessness. A really important part is actually getting a handle on how many people are we talking about? And I think it gives us the opportunity to try to think critically and possibly about solving that problem. If we don't have good information, we can't act.
Dan, you're volunteering to check how many homeless people you have in Riverton, Utah. Did I get that right?
Yeah. So our assignment is the south end of the valley. And so once we're done counting to like 2 or 3, we'll probably head up north and probably help Shireen. She's got her hands full up there south of Pioneer Park. And you know, I'm sure they're still accepting volunteers, right, Shireen?
So I don't know if they are, because at this point, tracks are assigned, but you can DM me if you are following me on social media, or you can contact your county government and they can point you in the direction of signing up for your PIT. And I know that they would love to have more volunteers next year.
Super interesting. In the last minute that we have on the program, I want to just ask both of you real quickly about Representative Angela Romero's bill that arms domestic violence survivors with options for protecting their pets. I thought it was a really nice gesture. I guess more than 70% of pet owners who arrive at a domestic violence shelter say their abuser also threatened their pet. Quick commentary, Shireen and Dan.
This is really an important piece of legislation. Abusers sometimes, you know, target people's pets in these kinds of violent situations. I also would like to call out, I think there's a group called Rough Patch that will temporarily take animals from people who are trying to leave domestic violence situations. So there's lots of support, but this is a good bill.
Yeah. Dan, quick commentary.
Hey, stop threatening pets.
There you go.
There you go.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Natalie Gochner, Shireen Gorbani, Dan McKay. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We look forward to speaking to you next week.